side one of an interview with Philip J. Helmuth on March 15th, 2006. And we're in 304 South Hall, and Judy Craig is the interviewer. Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. It's good to have you back here in South Hall. I come in about once every couple of weeks.
Gee. And I can't remember when I was here the last 3-4 years.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go back farther than that.
Okay.
And go way back, and talk about your childhood and schooling. What we're aiming for is to get,
well,
how
you got
here.
Well, you got all day. I mean, I could spend most of the time on item one.
I think we need to prioritize. So
tell
us a little bit about how you...
Okay. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, in the original part of the city on Prairie Avenue in 1937. And I lived in the city for 7 or 8 years. And then we moved out to Palos Park, which is a suburb. And I haven't been
Payless
there.
As in Payless Shoe Company?
The what?
As in Payless Shoe Company?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, that was a strictly a residential area.
Okay.
We were able to get out there at the end of World War II because Dad was a physician and he had gasoline coupons. Otherwise, you couldn't travel back and forth every day because it was out about 10 miles. I went to parochial school early, and then in second grade, when we moved to Palos, I had just the regular kind of schooling that you'd have Palos Park was past the suburbs. It was out, it was his own little area. Now it would probably be a suburb, and there's probably city running right up to it. There wasn't then. There was a lot of forest preserves, and it wasn't very populated. Which was nice because we had 7 acres, and it was just a great place to grow up.
Was it pretty clear always that you were going to go to college? Your dad
when I was 16, my father's health started to go. He was a practicing physician, and he had a medical school appointment at Loyola and 3 hospitals, and he practiced alone. And in his middle 40s, his health started going, so he was offered a position at Marquette Medical School in 1954. And I got uprooted after my junior year of high school, and we moved to Shorewood, north of Milwaukee. And I finished high school at Shorewood. Now, our family, both sides, mothers and fathers, were immigrant people, even though they were third generation or fourth generation even. And had this great belief in education. My father's father worked for a while in the waterworks in Chicago and decided that he wanted to further himself educationally. And so he went to the University of Illinois Pharmacy School in Chicago and graduated number one in his class. In the first class there in 1899, he won a microscope for being valedictorian, and I still have the graduation program. And that started, on that side of the family, the stress on education, and Grandpa passed it down to his kids. My mother's side, it was sort of the same kind of story. Her father worked as an accountant in a brewery. The White Eagle Brewery, which is white eagles when they're young, Polish white eagles. Polish eagles are white when they're young. And he decided that he wanted to further himself too, so he went to law school at night, and he graduated from Kent College of Law in Chicago, which is still in existence today, and became a lawyer. And when he left the White Eagle Brewery, they gave him a gold watch, which got passed down to me eventually. And whenever I look at that, I kind of think about what everybody went through to get there. So anyway, education was always very big. And of course, with Dad at a medical school, there was a lot of pressure on me to go not just to college, but to go to medical school. And
that's the one degree you don't have.
Well, I could probably go back and get it because I was a pre-med. I wanted to go to Notre Dame like he had. In fact, he went there to grade school, too. And I heard all these stories about Notre Dame, but Dad was determined that I go to a good school educationally, and so I wound up at the University of Chicago, which was over my head, pretty much. But eventually I adapted, and I still do keep up a little with Chicago activities, but probably not as much as I should. Having been a pre-med, I decided myself when I walked into comparative anatomy that this is not what I was going to do, period. Now, I'd worked in the medical school at Marquette. I'd worked with the very thing that's in the newspaper today, using live animals in experiments, live dogs. Used to get pound dogs. And I just decided that I just didn't want to do that. Dad was crowding me and pushing me, and so I just finished and graduated, and since I had so much biology and chemistry, I just finished in biological sciences and let it go at that. Well, the summer after I graduated, we had gone from living in Shorewood to the Holy Hill area, south of Hartford, and I was just kind of whiling the summer away on the farm. And when September rolled around, Dad asked me, you just can't do this, you know, now that school's starting again. And I said, well, what do you mean I'm done? And he said, no, I think you should go to law school. And I said, well, what are you talking about? You know, I don't really know much about that, care much about it. Although all of my mother's brothers were lawyers, and I was very familiar with the law that way. And Dad's older brother was a lawyer. So I wound up at Marquette Law School, registering the day before classes started. And I was hoping that I would either do well or do poorly in law school, because that would make up my mind. Well, in fact, like most of the students there, I did neither. You know, I certainly wasn't a shining star, but I was never really in academic trouble either. So it was at Marquette where I met my wife, to-be. She had come from St. Paul via the Dakotas and Nevada and the West, where she seemed to live all over at one time or other. And we got married after law school. And then I decided, well, you know, I really don't have enough education. I'm not going to practice law. I clerked at a couple of firms, and I just didn't like it. And so I inquired as to what was going on in Madison, and of course Dad is pushing me again, why don't you go get an MBA or do something like that. So I came out here and I talked to the business school people, and they said, yeah, you know, we'll take you in the MBA program, but you have to put in a semester because you have so many deficiencies. And so I did that and then got into the MBA program and finished that. And while working, while in school, our family began arriving, and I had to get a job. And so my major professor in the business school suggested I go down to the personnel office and talk to Mr. Bretzman, who ran it then. And when I got down there, Bretz, as he called, interviewed me himself and put me on right away. Well, I was a student hourly in an LTE until I finished, until I nearly finished my MBA, and then he had a permanent position. Those were the days when the budgets for the university were expanding, as I was to find out later when I came up to LNS. But he had a permanent position, and I took the civil service test and you know, passed. And the semester before I completed my MBA, I started working there part-time first, in a permanent position, then full-time. But right away I knew this isn't what I wanted to do either. And although personnel was fine, it wasn't difficult. The power structure for civil service in the state was distasteful, and it was too much parry and thrust. And not scientific enough, let's say. And so I really didn't care for that. Well, while I was in the personnel office, from time to time we'd have unemployment claims or workman's comp claims, worker comp claims, and there was really nobody to handle it, so Brett's asked me to do that. And so I did, and I handled an appeal of an unemployment comp case for the department secretary for the math department in L&S. She had left the university, she'd resigned her position, gone to California, and then filed an interstate unemployment comp claim. And Brett's asked me to, you know, just go make an appearance and see what's up.
This was about
1966. It's a good question. I came to the personnel office in 1964. I remember the first day of work that I had there, it was April 30th, 1964, and I was an LTE, and I attended a hearing, in fact, and it was 9 hours, and it was the end of a pay period, and it's the only time in a whole career at the university I ever got overtime. So, anyway. But the case, I went out, I made the appearance. It's not terribly difficult. Commission practice is simply fact-finding, mostly. And I don't know, a month later or so, the decision came down and it denied the claim. And a couple of days later, I got a call from Don Percy, who was in L&S then,
as an assistant dean.
Yeah, Don was here for maybe 9 months or 10 months on his way to, as we call it then, central administration and Bob Clodius's office and President Harrington's office. And he said, you know, he came down to see me, in fact, and he said, you know, I'm going to be leaving L&S. And I thought he was calling about the decision, which I was really happy about, you know. And he said, I'm leaving L&S, and we need somebody like you to take my place and, in fact, do a lot more stuff that I can't do. And so would I be interested? Well, I tried to pretend I wasn't interested, and of course, when I was very interested, employment interview games. And so a few days later, but I told him I was interested, and a few days later I got a call from Leon Epstein, and Leon said, why don't you come up and talk to me about this? And I did, and I found Leon to be a very engaging, wonderful guy. I mean, the same person he's been all these years. Now, this is 1966, maybe April or May. And he said, well, we'll be getting back to you. I have to interview somebody else. And I said, that's fine, you know. Because I was about to come off probation in civil service, which, you know, would give you, you know, lifelong tenure, you know. And not that I cared, I wasn't going to stay there very long anyway. So he called me a few days later and said, look, if you'd like to come up here, we'd like to have you, and I'm going to send you a letter if you're going to accept. And I said, I'm going to accept, send the letter. And then we talked about Title I, and he wanted me to be Bob Doremus' assistant, and I told him, well, I could be Bob's assistant, and I'd be working with him all the time. And I did for the first couple of years, but I didn't want to be an assistant to the associate dean because I never talked to Bob. And I'd rather be assistant to the dean. He said, that's fine. And he said, here's what we're going to pay you. And I said, well, he said, well, we'll give you a little more. And so I said, okay, that's great. When do I come up? And that's essentially how it started. I started in L&S on June 15th, 1966. And my first real meeting with Bob came the next day, or that day.
This is Bob Doremus, who was the associate dean for everything.
He was associate dean. You know, you'd call him executive associate dean today, senior associate, so whatever, you know. Although, in fact, the structure that Dave Cronin later put in was Leon already had. the associate dean system. And Bob Mulvihill, for example, was an associate dean all that time. Hugh Richards was an associate dean.
And he's from physics.
Yeah, from physics.
What was Hugh doing? I mean, he was doing the same thing.
Physical science, the same thing that Dave Clark would have done, perhaps, at a later date.
Was there anybody for the social sciences?
I don't remember, but I think there must have been. I think that person left, you know, sometime during the year. In fact, Don Percy was not appointed assistant dean, even though he had a short tenure by Leon, but by Ed Young, before Ed left to be president of Maine. Don had come from Princeton's, what's their highfalutin institute? He was a...
Woodrow Wilson?
No. It was in the physical sciences. Oh. And he'd gone to MRC, and then he'd come here. Rosser knew him from Princeton.
Okay.
J. Barclay Rosser, who was director then.
Of the Math Research Center.
Of the Math Research Center.
Otherwise, called the Army Math Research Center.
Well, yeah. There was some confusion over that.
Yeah.
And later it became a real problem. But anyway, so I'd come up, and Bob Doremus told me that he said, well, you know, you're going to have to learn this job by yourself. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I only take one vacation a year, but it's a whole month, and it starts tomorrow. Here is the research administration book. Why don't you just look at that? So fortunately, I had a two-week overlap with Don Percy. Now, my job at that time was strictly research administration. And what that comprised was proposal conferences and budget review. And I spent a lot of time with departments talking about the agencies and so forth. And shortly after my arrival, within the first week, Don said, come on in, I'm going to have a proposal conference with a person applying for a grant. And I came in, it took about an hour. And as I think back on it, it was probably the most thorough proposal prep interview I'd ever gone through, or back and forth I'd ever gone through. And Don had all the right terms, although the researcher was quite knowledgeable and it had funding from the agency before. It sort of set a model for what I did a lot of for a long time, probably 15 years.
Do you remember who that first conference was?
Frank Sherb, physics. Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, Frank and I became good friends for a long time. One of the questions here has to do with people, you know, and there's just too many to list them all, but they, I started doing that. Now, one of the questions here is when I came to LNS, what was the structure? And I thought about that last night, and we were very small then, and some of it had to do with the philosophy that the college had and the practical realities of the university at the time. LNS was by far the largest part of the university. It probably still is, but probably not by far. And so as a result, a lot of the business machinery was structured to cater to the college. And so, and this came out in different sorts of ways. Bob Doremus was respected by the people in the central business office, George Everson, for example, Clarence King, Hugh Hess, the people who actually received things from the colleges, not from the departments, but from the colleges. And in fact, if Bob had signed something, it was probably okay. Now, that meant that you didn't have to spend a lot of time in pre-audit. you really didn't have to spend a lot of time with research proposals, although since they went to federal agencies, most of them, you did. And the requisitions and so forth, you know, would just go through. Now, anybody who knew Bob or worked with him for very long would know that he was a very upright, upstanding, sensible administrator. In fact, as associate dean, he probably was the epitome of that and could have moved on. And in today's situation where people move more often, he probably could have run a college, maybe even a university if he wanted to, or been an excellent vice chancellor. But Bob was very much ingrown into the college, and I think that's probably it made him very efficient at what he was doing and very knowledgeable about what was going on everywhere. And some of this philosophy you could see and became a problem for me in the beginning, although I didn't realize it right away. Everything that left here, left South Hall, that went to the Peterson building, would have his signature on it, or his stamp signature. And Gene Gregg, who was his assistant then, would stamp Bob's name on to requisitions. And I would sign Bob's name to proposals and put a PJH afterward. And after about 6 months of this, and it became a problem to me because he wasn't always here, and a lot of proposal activity is you need immediate action, even though we'd say you have to leave in the dean's office 20 days or a week or whatever. Maybe you'd only get 20 minutes, you know, maybe only two. Because
some things
the agencies,
never changed,
because
did they?
Right, because the agencies had deadlines, and if you didn't meet them, you know, you've wasted an awful lot of time or effort. So anyway, but Bob was very good, and he squired me around and got me well grounded in the college and sort of the activities that we did with other schools. He took me to a round table luncheon, which was very small then, and it was a round table luncheon, and paid for my first lunch, and then we would go to this monthly.
What kind of talks were given then?
Same kind that they give today, okay. I think. You know, it would be faculty in research areas. It would be current event stuff. Mm-hmm. I remember when Bob Johnson, the hockey coach, came in. This was heresy because this was a faculty group, and uh-huh. Bob was talking about, you know, it's a great day for hockey. You know, but all that changed, and as the it used to be faculty roundtable luncheon, and it just became roundtable luncheon, and more people came in, and it became a problem because people felt they were excluded and so forth, and you know, but having been in it, that aspect never came up. Well, anyway, coming back from one of the meetings, from one of the luncheons, both of us with full stomachs and pleasant and sort of a pleasant atmosphere from the speaker. I said to Bob, I said, look, you know, you guys brought me up here to do this. I can't do this unless I have some independence, at least sign my own name. And Bob sort of looked at the cement as we were walking up Bascom Hill. He said, yeah, that's probably right. You know, why don't you just go ahead and do that? You know, just let me know if there's any sort of problem. Well, in fact, I relied on him a lot. He knew, and I had to learn, how faculty loads worked vis-a-vis research, how the splits on funding for people in other colleges were not the same as LNS. We didn't have budgeted research, but still we had research and so forth. And all of these things were little complications, but provided a great deal of assistance to researchers in obtaining time to do research. For example, I remember having just come up here, having a meeting on how much time a faculty member could commit to research and still teach full load. and because we had people who wanted to use research money for salary. And one of the things that you wanted to do here, and I saw Leon doing too, is to keep your faculty teaching. And he would work out things to...
He, Leon, or
yeah,
he, Bob?
Leon.
Leon.
Yeah, well, but we'd all sort of work on this. Mm-hmm. And so he worked out something with economics where they could teach 2-4 credit. I mean, I can't remember anymore, but it was all pretty clear and well known then. And we had this this roughly, and we did it from workload studies. Faculty had self-reported on spending research time, on spending, on how they spent their weeks, and how much time went into teaching, how much research, how much professional reading, a whole bunch of things that really became less and less relevant. But roughly about a third time was what was reported, and so we kind of used that. Well, if you think about it, and a lot of proposals are 2-year proposals, you could get a semester off on the agency, and there were cost-sharing requirements, by committing a third of each of the other 3 semesters to the project, which many investigators told me was minimal. You know, if they got a grant, they worked hard because they wanted another one and so forth. And so dealing with the research area, you know, always looked simple and easy and so forth. In fact, there are a lot of, and it's not complicated, but there are a lot of little details that are involved that that made this very important enterprise to make it workable and to do what we do. Now, at that time, and thinking about the interview here, I think we were probably at the end of the great era of higher education in the 20th century. After the riot era began, after the Dow incident, things weren't the same. And so I think Leon Epstein was probably the last dean that could take an egalitarian view of how all of this worked and how it had come down. And our position with the university was such that, you know, the college's position with the university was such that our impact was major, you know. In fact, then and for many years afterwards, we acted as the bank for the rest of the university. We'd have funds, and we'd take in projects. We'd take them right into the dean's office and have people here working on the Southeast Asian Education Project and the Criminal Justice Project when it was early. And all sorts of things would come and go, and they'd just stick it in LNS because we could take care of it, and then it wouldn't be a problem for somebody else. So anyway, as time went by, we also did our own budget in the college. But we didn't do it until maybe 1966 or 7 when the university budget office asked us to do the budget. And that's how I got into civil service, which I didn't want to get away from, which I really want to get away from.
Could you explain just a little bit what you mean by doing the budget?
Well, the budget then, everything then was done by hand. It was all paper. And the LNS budget would be about 2 inches tall in these printout sheets that were maybe 11 by 15. It would come in books. There must be a name for it, which I don't remember if I ever knew anyway. And it would have every single person in the college that appeared on a payroll reflected back in the budget. I mean, it was a horrible thing. And every person in every single department, be they faculty, academic staff, or classified, and plus amounts for student hourly and teaching assistant amounts and so forth. And then we had a department called General Interdepartmental at that time, which was probably the most useful administrative tool ever devised by the mind of man. Actually, Don Percy had done it because we'd gotten a lot of money right before I came, and those were the money years, and we had to put it someplace. And apparently, in succeeding years, they forgot we had it, you know, but anyway. And so by doing the budget, simply meant Jerry Hinkle was then assisting Leon Epstein, and Jerry left to go to Central when Ed Young came back to be vice president and then chancellor. And she did, she worked over everything. She made the corrections, she entered the new names, she did everything, but she didn't know what to do with classified, and so bingo, it winds up on my desk one day. Well, I didn't want to do that. I mean, classified was handled by someone else, but that person had left, and the people who handled it before were not going to handle it again. So I just picked that up. But in the process, I got some help with the research stuff, which was good because that was growing and more important than ever. So anyway, that put me into classified again.
Not your own position, but having responsibilities for classified.
Well, no. The position was assistant to the dean. It became assistant dean right away, I mean, the next year or something like that. But that just got added in.
Is tape two, side two? I mean, tape one, side two of the interview with Phil Hellmuth on March 15th, 2006, and you were talking about the budget process.
Yeah, and so after we would get the budget, I had some help. And so our material, we finished up, it all added up and we sent it on down, and it was always fine. Okay, but Jerry didn't have any help. Jerry Hinkle didn't have any help with hers. And it was much bigger. The classified budget was about 12%, 10 to 15% of the whole budget, which wasn't very, very much, although it was about 10 million bucks as it moved along.
And it included all of the people in the department.
All the permanent classified, yeah. All the student hourlies. Is there anything else in there? I don't remember. I think that's it. Oh, and then there was also a line for temporary help, but we changed those things to suit ourselves as time went by. Anyway, two things would happen then. Our budget would go down, and right away, somebody would get a call up here saying that the faculty budget doesn't add up. And I remember one day going down there and going down to Leon and Jerry's office and said, I hear that it doesn't add up. And Jerry was just fit to be tied. She said, you know, all I have is this Marchand calculator and I can't be expected to do that sort of thing. Now that budget is correct. They can add it up. They've got the machines. And I just kind of backed out of the office and let it go at that. And so that's how we got into that. And then the second thing that would happen is it didn't add up. And then after somebody did add it up, after the first payroll, we have to have budget confirmation sheets. And this was just a horrible thing. I mean, it would take up all kinds of time. Our payroll people, which were always harried, especially at the start of an academic year and the start of a semester and even summer session, would have to reconcile the budget confirmation sheets. And it just was an awful process, and they didn't want to do it.
Were the payroll people part of your responsibility at that time? Or research?
I have to back up a little there. When I came here, research was strictly my area. There was a gentleman named Tim Dean, who a member of the renowned, you know, well-known Dean family in Madison, who was here as a systems and procedures analyst, and he had picked up, he was going to be the kind of person who would go around the college and evaluate efficiency and do things like that. Something that, all the time I was in LNS,
Dean?
Ed or, Yeah.
Oh,
well, it was,
okay.
It was a range 13 or 14 civil service pay. It wasn't a 6 or 7 level position. And Tim was well educated. He was a bright guy. Mm-hmm. Is a bright guy.
I'm just sort of surprised that that was something that we wanted to spend our money on.
Oh yeah. Well.
Efficiency. I mean, it's just.
Well, after
okay.
he left, we didn't replace him.
Okay.
But along with that, well, part of it had to do was to evaluate. I mean, in terms of scientific management, how many support staff a department should have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, not just what they had, but to do that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
and how much money they really needed to run operations.
Yeah, it was you know. The day of that kind of analysis, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, it was. So anyway, well, Tim and I were great friends in the 6 months we were here. He had payroll and he had personnel too, although it really wasn't clear what had happened there. I'm getting lost here a little. Stop a minute.
Yeah.
And the reason we got in this was Tim had left.
Okay.
And I think the reason Tim had left was when I came up to the college, I had to from a permanent civil service position, I had to go through the then Committee on Classified Personnel.
Mm.
And Leon took the...
Because you were changing from classified
position to unclassified. Because I was changing
from
classified
to
unclassified,
yeah.
Right. And so Leon had written to the committee, and he'd also written that Tim Dean be taken from systems and procedures analyst to assistant to the associate dean or assistant dean too. Well, the committee approved me, but they turned Tim down. Yeah, ostensibly because I had done graduate work, had graduate degrees, he didn't. Although that criteria might have been a lot different a few years later. And I think that this bothered Tim enough and that he wasn't gonna keep his stake in the college anymore. And I don't know how well he got along with Bob Doremus anyway, but well enough. And so when he had a business opportunity in January or February of 1967, he took it and left. And that position was open for a long time. We never even contemplated refilling it. And at that time, we weren't worried about FTEs in the dean's office. We didn't have many anyway, so we just let it sit. And it sat for a long time. Having gone through this horrible budget experience, and then Bob Doremus started getting hassled, is I think a fair term, by the business office, which was unusual for them to say anything about Bob, about how we were spending money in the college. Bob thought it was time that we get somebody in just to do the budget and to do this kind of stuff. And
do you mean the appropriateness of the way we were spending money, or that we didn't seem to know what we were doing?
We didn't know what we were doing
okay.
with our money.
Because we couldn't
which
put
was,
the budget together.
Which Bob resented enormously.
Mm-hmm.
We all did, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's the same old story about, you know, accountability from a central to a central office when they're not running the programs. I mean, you see this with James Bond and Q all the time, you know. Bring my stuff back intact, says Q, and James Bond says, well, buddy, you haven't been in the field.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the sort of thing that you were faced with here. So, but Bob is a bright guy on all this kind of stuff, and he knew that we're going to get increasingly held to at least some knowledge of what we were doing, and we couldn't even say that then. I mean, we knew it was going, and it wasn't a problem anywhere and so forth. So anyway, that's when the search for Dave Dean began, that resulted in getting Dave Dean. And we talked to at least two or three other people who weren't, who would have liked to have had the job, but probably, and might have been able to do it, but really weren't quite right for it.
And you were looking for a person who could handle the budget?
Take the budget.
Budget responsibilities.
Take the budget from development, preparation, bookkeeping, commitments, keeping track of, doing all this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's going to be enough time in this interview to cover it all, because you got me going into such detail, but
yeah.
When Steve Klaney became dean, it was a damn good thing we had Dave Dean. But anyway,
Let me say, we'll talk as long as you're willing to erase that, but okay, go ahead.
Okay, whatever, that's okay. After looking at several people, none of whom are really acceptable. George Everson, who was director of contracts and research administration before Len Van Ness took the position, and one of the major lieutenants of Vice President Cafferty at the time, who was business and finance vice president, and a bright, knowledgeable individual who Bob had enormous respect for, and so did I as I got to know George better. Recommended that we interview Dave Dean, who was coming back from the Northern Nigeria Project. He spent a year or two there with them.
And that was the School of Education
project, and that went on for some time, and he was the business manager. Well, Bob wrote him a letter of offer sight unseen, and in fact, I think we interviewed Dave after we'd hired him. But anyway,
I want to say that Bob Doremus is one of the most careful individuals.
But he had enormous respect for George Everson.
Uh-huh.
And there wasn't any way we could interview him anyway because he was out of the country.
Yeah.
And I remember when Dave came in, and I think September of 1968, and I mean, it was such a relief for everybody to have, to know that at least we had somebody who was knowledgeable and could do things there. And over time, you know, my impression of Dave was that he knew how to keep up with the technology on things very well. And it was very important that we did, because most of us were just kind of so-so on that. It wasn't that important to us.
There was very little technology available to us at the college level
that time. Dave hadn't been here a month, and NSF cut all the budgets by 20%. And that became, and we hadn't, I don't know, a large number of NSF grants. It was one of our major funders.
Mm-hmm.
He worked out budget reductions on every one of those things. And I shared my office with him for maybe a year or two. We were in 206, which was Don Percy's old office. And I smoked cigars at the time, and he smoked cigarettes. We could have that office so filled with smoke. I mean, a smoke-filled mm-hmm. room wouldn't have been that smoke-filled, and he'd be looking at ways to do this quicker, and you know, and I'd be kind of watching him, you know, figuring out what he was going to do, and then he'd make a suggestion and so forth. So I think in the time that we shared the office, I got to know Dave very, very well, and in a way, it was to our mutual benefit to do that, because while I didn't get into that area very much, I had the classified budget, and he was always looking for money, and as subsequent deans went through, especially in Dave Cronin's time when we were getting shorter and shorter money, I had to save more and more, and it was helpful to have Dave to be sure that the allocations were right, because I never did that. So anyway, after Dave came, he hadn't been there very long. In fact, he might not have even been there. I can't remember now. We come to perhaps the end of higher education as we knew it from, say, the after World War I to Vietnam, when we had the Dow riot. Now, I'd been in the Peterson building when they had the first sit-in, and Chancellor Fleming had one in his office and so forth, but these were just small potatoes compared to the Dow riot, which was a real riot, and there were people injured, and
Leon Epstein was dean then?
Leon was dean.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had a fire in the records room here in South Hall.
Was the records room in the basement?
And the records room was in the directly across from where the dean's office was then. I don't know,
okay.
Is the dean still down there?
Yes.
Okay.
He's moved into the records room.
Oh, yes.
So it was Student Academic Affairs
Yeah,
Records.
Student Academic Affairs.
Okay.
Room. Yeah, sure. It was firebombed through the through the windows. Fortunately, the fire got put out. But in my office right above it, for years and years afterwards, there were little creepy, little carbon indentations that looked like flames from the heat coming up and probably forcing the dust from this 100-year-old building up as much as anything else. But I look at that and remind myself of that, and I'll come back to this later because this comes out in another way too. So anyway, I think President Harrington wasn't, now remember, I'm low down in the chain, you know, but it's a small chain, you know, and a small group. President Harrington, I think in Leon's opinion, didn't want to pursue, to go after the people who did this criminal act vigorously, and didn't want to, for example, they left a gas can, tried to trace it, or there were some evidences there, and central administration wasn't terribly interested in pursuing it, and I think that soured Leon on the deanship. And plus, you know, when you were dean then, I mean, he wrote a book, a wonderful book, and he was able to do things that subsequent deans couldn't do because they didn't have the time to do it, and the administrative burden just became too much. And, you know, sort of as an aside here, I mean, this gave all of us in the who took PhDs, as I did from the Ed Administration Department, which I guess they changed their name now.
Yes, Educational Leadership and
Policy.
They call it ELPA.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Everybody wants a little better title, you know.
I don't know about ELPA.
I don't either. But.
When did you start going to graduate school again?
That's another question.
Okay, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah,
but.
No. Okay, all right. So anyway, and you know, and I'm not sure that I think Leon did an excellent job as dean, probably as good a job as any dean had done, although he was only there for 4 years. But it probably was good that he left, because I don't think that he was on the same lines with central admin, and when that happens, you know, things are not, you know, become very unsettled and perhaps unhealthy organizationally. But anyway, Leon told me that he was going to resign, and he said, I wanted you to know this before I tell the regents and so forth, and so he did, and you know, I felt bad about
69,
that.
69, was it?
68.
Okay.
68 or 9, it could have been 69. Okay. Then Steve Klanning comes in.
And he was a mathematician.
Yeah, Steve was a mathematician, and Leon had a lot of personality. Dave Cronin did too.
Now, I'd say both Leon was an eminent political scientist.
Yeah.
And Steve Klanning was an eminent mathematician.
Probably, yeah. I wouldn't want to compare ratings, but you know, Steve was
he's very, very well known.
Yeah, he probably, in terms of intellectual discipline and pursuit, probably the epitome of all the deans we've had. But in administrative leadership, you know, not so high. Mm-hmm. Steve didn't exude a lot of personality. A lot of people found him difficult to talk to or deal with, and hard to get to know really well. But I always knew him well for a couple of reasons. Number one, he was a swimmer, and I spent most of my life swimming. And one day I caught him in the pool, and he told me that he backstroked with on the same team that George Kojak was on, which impressed me no end. This is from the 20s and 30s. And when he was in office, my father died. And my father was working on a book, and Steve told me, came to me and said, you know, you just take the time you need, you got to finish that, it's important. I knew what your father was doing. And I said, oh. But it never was a problem. Dad had help, and most of that got done that way. But if you got to know him, he was warm and interested. But if you didn't, he didn't have immediate pickup skills that made you think, gee, this is a real warm guy that I'd like to talk to, you know. And I think that, and plus he'd make some blunt statements. You know, the high jumping rule, which is probably still knocking around the colleges.
Oh yes, very famous.
Gave him all kinds of problems. But in fact, it's the rule we have today. I mean, when you go for tenure, it's what you need to go then. I mean, it's not based on what happened 5 years ago, your colleague who made it last year, whatever. But this, of course, by people who spent their time getting a PhD, spending, you know, 2 to 6 years as an assistant professor, you know, and then being told that, well, wait a minute, there's no certainty in any of this, that really didn't go over very well. And plus, some of the department's more senior people weren't sympathetic to that kind of thing either, even though that's what they did in the department. Steve's general inability to see, to even though he was a great mathematician, he didn't work numbers budgets very well. And this is where Dave Dean became very important, because Steve would make commitments and wouldn't, and he had his own little accounting methods, which you know, even Bob Remus couldn't figure out, you know, and we would come out of these budget meetings sort of wringing our hands trying to figure out what had happened or what he was doing. And you know, the 5 years that Steve passed as dean just kind of went along with most of the activity turned elsewhere anyway, because you know we were in this riot era. But what was I doing then? Well, you know, so I picked up the classified budget. Later I picked up parking.
Were you going to school then?
Oh, well, yeah, okay. Well, we'll return to that.
Okay.
So anyway, in 1967 or 8, I just completed my MBA in 66 or 65, and I thought that probably what's happening today was that things like the MBA, which were new, were fast becoming credentials in the field, and it looked to me like it was the same thing was going to happen in higher education. In fact, people were getting PhDs and so forth. And so I went down one day to talk to Ken Little, who was a former vice president, good friend, too, as it turned out, and said to him, well, what do you think I should do? And he said, well, do you want a career here? You know, and I said, well, I want a career in higher education, I think. You know, when I had taken my MBA, I really wasn't interested in commodities existence, you know, stock existence, this kind of stuff. Or working around a product. And so he said, well, you know, if you can do it, you know, a lot of our classes are not during work time. In fact, none of them are. They were all in the evenings and Saturday mornings. And so I took a couple of years, and I talked to Leanne, and I said, you know, what do you think? And he said, do it. You know, you got time. You know, may be beneficial. You know, you're young yet. So he didn't quite put it that way, but that was the implication. And so I did, and I spent a couple of years then. I probably took 12 credits or 14 credits. And then there wasn't any, you know, you were admitted to the program just like that. I mean, no GRE, no nothing. you know, no extensive interviews and so forth. So then, you know, that was fine, and then they started having, then I started running up against some of the rules of the grad school. A year in residency without work or anything else, foreign language requirement, which I didn't have and probably wasn't going to have, although I was working on Spanish, you know, it still wouldn't, it wasn't going to work. And so it just kind of lapsed for a while. Well, from maybe 1970 to 74 or 5, a bunch of grad students took on the grad school on this residency role because they had no way of monitoring it. And they didn't take on the grad school at the university, they did it with the regents. And the regents said, well, what's going on? The grad school couldn't answer. And so the pronouncement was made at that meeting, well, we're going to suspend this rule until you tell us how you're going to actually work it. Well, I mean, there were a whole bunch of us behind the dam, boom, you know. And so everybody got in, and in the meantime, they dropped the foreign language requirement anyway, any foreign language requirement. Well, people were asking would American Sign Language qualify? I mean, it got to be, you know. So anyway, I just sort of went in with that. Now, Martin Loeb, who was director of the School of Social Work at the time, said, you know, well, here's your chance, you know. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you can register. This is May. You can register back to January. You know, you can. I said, Martin, I'm not going to do that. You know, and I didn't, although a lot of these guys did, and women did. And boom, boom, and they're out. So, but I registered the next year, and you had to have permission to do this. And now Ken Little had left.
And the thing was, the issue was working full-time. I mean, you couldn't work, in theory, full-time and be a graduate student full-time. But you had to be a graduate student full-time in order to meet the requirements,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So that's the issue.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, but it's really both ways. Plus, I had 5 kids. Mm-hmm. What I had to do, I mean, it's political, Judy.
What well, I had went to through do, it too.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
But well, I wasn't in do, the transition time.
Okay. Well, what I had to do, well, what they decided then, the rule then became, if you had permission from your employer and your a major professor was okay. Well, Ken Little had moved on, and Joe Kaufman was now my major professor. And I had a lot of fun with Joe over all of this and all this time. So the thing would be, and Joe said, look, you know, you gotta get your PhD, quit fooling around here, you know, you can do it, you know. And I wasn't terribly motivated to do it, although I
you
thought
you did
it was
have
better.
Several degrees already.
Yeah,
so.
I did, you know, I did. And it probably wasn't gonna change things at work, although Dave said that it would. And so, the thing was to get Bob Doremus to approve this. So I told Bob that I think Joe Kaufman will approve this if you do. And Bob looked at me and he said, oh, you know, this is all real controversial stuff. And I said, well, yeah, I know. But, you know, I think he'll do it. And would you? And he said, well, yeah, you got some time invested in this anyway, so let's try it once. And once turned out to be 10 times or whatever.
Every semester you had
yeah,
to have them.
And I had my research topic. The first one flopped, but the second one was really good. And in fact, I could talk about this. I probably still can, although I've taken my name off the speaker's list on it. Although I still get calls anytime there's a change in residency for tuition purposes or reciprocity or anything like that, or the legal basis behind all of this stuff. And that, in fact, was my thesis. I did a survey of the 50 state universities, and the problem was I got my material back really fast, but then it took me a long time to write the thesis, and I just sat on it. I just sat on it for 4 or 5 years. And finally it got down to the point where, well, two things happened. Number one, you were going to start having to pay money to stay in the queue. You know, it used to be, you know, you'd pass prelims and then you'd show up 3 or 4 years later and graduate, you know, assuming you got your thesis filed and your committee and so forth. Well, now to keep track of you was going to start costing money.
And you had to keep registering.
Yeah, you had to keep registering. And you'd have to take, and you'd have to get some kind of progress report, you know. And so Joe Kaufman called me and he said, you know, this is going to change everything for you. You know, why aren't you doing it? He used to send me little notes in the summer from Massachusetts, you know. And or he'd say things like, well, you know, I know that you're active in this area and you do a lot of work here, you know. This can't be too difficult. Well, it wasn't. So anyway, at Christmas in 1980, I think, or no, New Year's, we're sitting down to watch the bowl games, and Lynn gets between me and the TV, and she says, no, we're not going to do this. And I said, come on, hon, I'm just trying to see it, you know. She said, no, you know, the six of us have only one resolution, and that you complete your PhD and you start right now.
Uh-huh. And good for Lynn.
And I thought, oh God, now my goose is cooked, you know. So I went back, I mean, the files were all dusty and everything, and I dusted it all off, and eventually I did it, and I remember writing the last chapter sitting on our pier up at our summer home, and then turning the thing in and finishing.